This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Booker T. Jones and Alan Toussaint helped create the soul soundtrack of the 60s and 70s. Jones led Booker T. and the MGs, which was not only the house band for Stax Records, but scored 7 top 40 instrumental hits. Today we'll feature Terry's 2007 conversation with Booker T. But first, a look at new solo albums from Booker T. and from Alan Toussaint, who worked as a songwriter, producer, and pianist on a host of recordings, including hits for Lee Dorsey and the group LaBelle. Critic Milo Miles has this review of both new recordings.
Every time a veteran performer releases a new record, he or she faces a basic challenge. Unless you want to be a mere nostalgia act, how do you make yourself sound either timeless or contemporary? If you're a singer, it's easier. Choosing apt modern material can do half the update for you. But pop instrumentalists often fall flat if they try to sound with it, and tired if they run through the same old thing. Unlikely as it seems, two venerable keyboardists, Booker T. and Alan Toussaint, have both met the challenge. On The Bright Mississippi, Toussaint sounds eternal as New Orleans. And on Potato Hole, Booker T. pulls his grooves right into today. The key with Toussaint is that he's finally made a solo album that reflects all the facets of his New Orleans background. In the 60s and 70s, Toussaint made a series of good but uneven albums that included a lot of what he calls boogieing and woogieing. And on The Bright Mississippi, his Hepcat style makes a welcome curtain call on Thelonious Monk's title tune, of all things. Producer Joe Henry assembled a backing group fluent in jazz and comfortable with pop vernaculars, including Don Byron on clarinet, Nicholas Payton on trumpet, and Mark Rebo on guitar. While most numbers on this set come from the jazz canon, they're constantly articulated with blues and gospel accents and served up with the unmistakable slow cooking of New Orleans. Whether Toussaint's reworking Duke Ellington, Sidney Bechet, or Django Reinhardt, he infuses the numbers with his own elegant funk, particularly evident in his piano work, never so varied and flowing. Toussaint hadn't made a solo album in 10 years, but Booker T. had been away from the scene for almost 20, which makes it even more surprising that he's got the more up-to-date sound on Potato Hole. This album shows the advantage of first listening without knowing who's playing. How did he make this version of the MGs sound so sprightly and slyly funky? Turns out the backing band is the Drive-By Truckers, a well-respected youngish southern rock group. And who's that doing the piercing guitar solos that blend noise and blues so well? Turns out it's Booker T's old buddy Neil Young on 9 of 10 tracks. He leads the charge here in Native New Yorker. We'll be right back. were no guarantees with this collaboration. Neil Young was only so-so playing with Pearl Jam a while back, and a couple years ago, the Drive-By Truckers failed to connect well with revived veteran soul singer Betty LaVette. On Potato Hole, however, everybody's instincts work in harmony, right down to brilliant covers of the Deep South hip-hop of Outkast and Tom Waits' Get Behind the Mule, the perfect newy oldie newy. I've never liked the term comeback, because after a while, big players can never come back to what they were. What performers and fans can do is keep the faith. If the talent survives, and the effort is made, and the stars align, the grateful crowds should be there to listen.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. Terry spoke with Booker T in 2007, the same year that Booker T and the MGs won a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys. Booker T and the MGs was the house band for the Memphis-based soul label Stax Records. They backed up artists like Otis Redding, Rufus and Carla Thomas, Sam and Dave, Wilson Pickett, Albert King, and the Staple Singers. And they had their own hits in the 60s and 70s, including Soul Limbo, Hip Hugger, and Time Is Tight. They also did covers like Mrs. Robinson, Hang 'em High, and Ode to Billy Joe. Their first and biggest hit was Green Onions, recorded in 1962 with Steve Cropper on guitar, Al Jackson drums, and Louis Steinberg bass. Steinberg was later replaced by Donald Duck Dunn. Before we hear Terry's conversation with Booker T, here's a taste of Green Onions.
Booker T, welcome to Fresh Air. It's an honor to have you on our show.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to be here.
Would you tell us the story behind the track that we just heard?
Well, that happened something of an accident. We were at the studio as session musicians to play a session for an artist who didn't show up. So we used the time to record our blues, which we called Behave Yourself, and I played it on Hammond M3 organ. And Jim Stewart, the owner, was the engineer, and he really liked it, thought it was great, actually, and wanted to put it out as a record. And So we all agreed on that, and Jim told us that we needed something to record for a B-side because we couldn't have a one-sided record. And one of the tunes that I'd been playing on piano, we tried on Hammond organ so that, you know, the record would have organ on both sides. And that turned out to be Green Onions.
Now, you know, Booker T and the MGs basically became the house band for Stax Records, and you played on a lot of their recordings. How did you become a member of the Stax house band?
Well, I was in 11th grade, and my friend David Porter knew that Rufus Thomas and his daughter Carla were recording one day, and I guess they had requested a baritone sax part on a song, and David thought of me. David drove over to the high school, came up with some type of hall pass and got me out of class and somehow came up with the band director's car keys and keys to the instrument room. So down we went to get the baritone sax out of the instrument room and into the borrowed car and over to Stax Records and through the door, and there I was.
Why don't we hear the recording that you played baritone sax on, which is your first recording for Stax. You want to introduce it for us?
It's called "Cause I Love You" by Rufus and Carla Thomas.
Okay, let's hear it. Rufus and Carla Thomas, the first recording that was that featured Booker T, but he wasn't on keyboards. He was on baritone saxophone, and Booker T is my guest. So you stayed, obviously. I mean, you were in 11th grade. You made this recording, and you ended up becoming part of the house band. How did they? Mm-hmm. Was it hard to convince you to stay? Did you have to convince them that they needed you?
Oh, I convinced them. I actually had a paper route. That was my job in the afternoon. And I convinced them to try me out on piano and eventually organ. And I eventually played on a organ on a William Bell song, which they liked that part, You Don't Miss Your Water, on one of the sessions. So after I played that part, I had the job.
So what was it like going to high school and making records at the same time?
Oh, it was unreal. I was in a rush to get out of school and get my papers thrown and get over to Stax. That was my thrill every day, to get to go there and play music until, you know, 10 or 11 o'clock every night.
Booker T and the MGs is so associated with the Stax sound, such an essential part of what is described as the Stax sound. But how would you describe the Stax sound?
I would say it's a simple, earthy sound, you know, born out of our blues and country and jazz roots, and also gospel. It was a sound that, you know, we consciously tried to keep simple and with a lot of feeling.
Do you remember the first time you met Otis Redding?
Yes. Otis was a valet for a band from Georgia, and he was carrying the clothes, and he was doing the driving and going for the food and coffee and shining shoes or whatever he had to do to keep the band going. And I remember the day he pulled up with Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers was the name of the group he was working for. They just basically came in, and he sat around and waited, and they did their demo for Stax. And after they did their demo, Otis asked if he could sing a song, which was a little inappropriate. But we allowed him, Jim and Steve Cropper and the rest of us, allowed him to sing a song with us. And that song was These Arms of Mine. And so everyone was moved by that. So at that moment, he became Otis Redding.
So let's hear one of the records you made with Otis Redding. How about Dock of the Bay? Do you have memories of making this record?
Yes, I do have memories of that. That was a particularly special and hectic time. Otis was getting ready to go out on tour without us, and we had just returned to Memphis from the Monterey Pop Festival in Europe, and Otis was disjointed and hurried and anxious and out of sorts, so he wanted to record all the time. He was insisting that we stay, you know, uncommon hours, and we were working late at night, and people were probably sleeping at the studio, and it seemed like we were working around the clock.
Well, that's not how it sounds on the record. It's not a record that sounds like it was made by people who were tired and overworked. Did the mood change once you started recording?
I'm not sure that we were tired and overworked when we did this particular one, but the week was one that we recorded, I think, a whole album in just a few days. So this might have been, I'm not sure what the sequence was when we recorded this, but, you know, the music always took its, it always created its own energy once we started playing. So even if you were tired, you know, playing with Otis and playing with each other, the music just, you know, it just got a life of its own. And so the tiredness didn't matter.
Well, let's hear Dock of the Bay, Otis Redding, and my guest Booker T on keyboards on this recording.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting in the evening sun, watching the ships roll in, then I'll watch them roll away again, yeah. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide. Watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me.
Otis Redding and my guest Booker T played piano and organ on many of the recordings on Stax Records, like the one we just heard. Were you close with Otis Redding?
Yes, unfortunately, yes.
Unfortunately, because he died in a plane crash.
Yes, he was a very close friend of mine. Yes.
And on that same plane were several members of the Barquets, a band that also recorded on Stax. Did it make you think twice about flying? I mean, musicians, there's such a history of plane and car accidents for musicians who are so spend so much time on the road.
Well, yes, Terry, it did make me think twice about flying in the smaller planes and the single double-engine twin planes. I still trust the jets, and I still trust destiny. So I'm okay with flying.
You wrote a song called Born Under a Bad Sign.
Mm-hmm.
That I always thought was a much older song. I mean, it's such a kind of classic blues song. I figured it was around a whole lot longer. You want to tell us the story behind writing the song?
Yes. The company had acquired Albert King as an artist, and I was assigned to be his producer. And so we needed music for him. And at that time, my partner was William Bell, my writing partner, and he came over to the house late one night, actually the night before the session, and, you know, we need something for Albert King. And William wrote the words, and I wrote the music in my den that night. And that was one of my greatest moments in the studio as far as being thrilled with a piece of music. I was very, very happy with the way that turned out.
What made you so happy about it? What do you particularly like about it?
The feeling of it, you know, it's the real blues, you know, done by the real people. It was Albert King from East St. Louis, you know, the left-handed guitar player, who was just such one of a kind, and so electric, and so intense, and so serious about his music, and involved with his with the lyrics and with the song. You know, he just lost himself in the music, and he was such a one of a kind character. And we had written a song for him, and we were doing it, and it was coming off, and I was there personally in the middle of it, so it was just exhilarating. You know, it's kind of hard to describe.
Well, why don't we hear it? This is Albert King, recorded in 1967, and my guest is Booker T, who's featured on this track. Albert King from 1967. The song was co-written by my guest, pianist and organ player Booker T, who co-wrote that song. Now, when you were playing at Stax Records, when you were in Booker T and the MGs, and you were the house band and making your own records, the South was still pretty segregated, but your band was comprised of African-American and white musicians. Did racial tensions from the outside world ever affect the band, or did you feel pretty well protected by that, from that?
Well, we were insulated, you know, as most Southern social institutions are. We were insulated because we had our little door there that we locked behind us at Stax, and nobody knew what was going on in there or who we were. So we weren't affected until we became pretty famous. Around 67 or 68, after Dr. King came to the city, and Dr. King was murdered in a place that was very close to us. He was murdered at the Lorraine Hotel, and that was our meeting place, and that was a place where we ate very often. So that affected us. But in general, we didn't have big racial issues there.
When you say the assassination affected you, did it? I mean, I imagine everybody in the band was pretty upset about it. Did it?
Mm-hmm.
Did it cause any?
What I mean
tensions
is, what I mean
the band?
Is, it,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. it brought outside attention to us and what we were doing there.
Right.
The fact that we were interracial, I like to call it a not too well kept secret that we were interracial. I think, you know, when we were playing music, that nobody really cared that we were interracial. I think they cared more about the music. I think whites and blacks both didn't pay too much attention to the racial aspect of it.
Did you feel there were times you needed to keep it kind of a secret?
Absolutely. The logistics of it demanded it. You know, we couldn't travel when we started without having two of us go get food, and sometimes those two were myself and Al, or sometimes those two were Steve and Doug. The other two would have to check into hotels. And,
right, because two of you were white, two of you were black.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So we always had to have, we were always in somebody else's territory, no matter where we were.
Mm-hmm.
So, Steve and Duck and all of the white members of Stax began to love soul food, and they, I think they preferred to hang out at our restaurants. You know, so we just really didn't have a problem as long as the rest of the world didn't have a problem with us.
We were talking before about how when you started at Stax Records, you were in high school, and you continued to high school, and then, in fact, you went to college and studied mm-hmm. music mm-hmm. after high school while you were mm-hmm. still playing at Stax. And while you were gone, Isaac Hayes would play piano or organ, is that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yes. Isaac filled in for me in the house band and played organ and piano on lots of great records.
Now, so many people, if they were in your position, would say, well, the heck with college or even high school. I have what I've always wanted to do. I'm you know, making my own records. I'm in the house band of a growing record company who needs school. Mm-hmm. What kept you going to high school and college in spite of the success that you were having?
Well, I had not yet met my own standards. I wasn't yet writing the music that I was hearing in my mind. I had a classical background, and I had the curiosity for all of the European greats that had written so much wonderful classical music, and I needed to know how to arrange for the orchestra. I needed to know how to conduct, and I needed to know how to arrange and write music for my job at Stax also. So I just had to continue my education in order to try to improve myself as a musician.
You know, had I just been listening to your records, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have guessed that you were into classical music, and I might not mm-hmm. have known that you were as kind of studious and mm-hmm. serious mm-hmm. sounding as you are.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, I spent many hours as a boy listening to my mother play classics. My mother was a classical pianist.
Uh-huh.
And then when I was at Indiana, you know, they had a great, great library underneath the music building, which was free and open 24 hours a day. So I spent many hours under there, you know, listening to the old masters, you know, everything from Bach to Stravinsky to Chopin and learning that music and learning how it was put together and studying.
How did she feel about the music you were playing at Stax? Your mother?
She loved it.
She good.
She loved it. She loved it. Uh-huh. She loved it. Yeah, she was at the time my greatest fan. She kept a scrapbook, and she loved it. But I was fortunate. Both my parents were fans.
You played a lot of different instruments when you were young. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong here. You played ukulele, oboe, saxophone, mm-hmm. trombone, piano, organ.
Yeah.
Clarinet.
Yeah.
Did having a working knowledge of all of those instruments help you as a musician, and as a musician who is so often, you know, accompanying singers?
Yeah, I think it did. I think it helped me get the structure of music in my mind, starting with oboe, which was a C instrument. And I played that when I was in fourth grade because I was too young to be in the band and they wouldn't let me in, but no one else would play oboe, so I took that up. And that's how I got in the band in fourth grade. And then moving from that to clarinet, which was a B-flat instrument, and then from that to piano, which was another C instrument, helped me get, you know, the structure of music in my mind.
Does it bother you when really funky records like the Booker T and the MGs records are used as an argument against classical music. Do you know what I mean?
I didn't know about that.
I don't mean that people single out your records, but often people who like, like funk or soul or music that sounds more like bluesy or improvisational will use it as an argument against what they perceive to be like stuffy, old, European, formal music.
Well, the melody to Time is Tight was written, I wrote that in Paris on the banks of the River Seine, and if you would ask for a classical melody from me, I think that would be it. Do you know the song Time is Tight?
I do.
Uh-huh. Well, if you listen to the melody, listen to the simplicity of it, and I think that was born out of my classical roots, actually. It's not a 12-bar blues, it's an odd number of bars, and I listen to people like Jean Sibelius and people who wrote these long flowing melodies and found a personal comfort in that type of thing, and a lot of people tell me that they just love that song, makes them feel relaxed and comfortable, So, there's a lot to be said for classical music, I think, that people don't know where the influences come from.
Well, I think we should listen to Time is Tight. So here it is. Time is Tight, Booker T and the MGs. Time is Tight, Booker T and the MGs from 1969. It's featured on the new Stax 50th Anniversary Celebration Collection. My guest is Booker T, who played a piano and organ on many recordings on Stax Records, the Booker T and the MGs recordings, and a lot of artists as well. You left Stax Records in 1969,
mm-hmm.
Which I think was the same year Stax was sold to Gulf and Western.
Mm-hmm.
Did that have any reason? Was that part of the reason why you left?
I left after Stax was sold to Gulf and Western.
Because it was sold, or?
Well, not because it was sold, but because it changed. Because the owners had control, and the owners were able to dictate how this company was run. And so they did that. They had every right to do that. They had big companies, and they knew what they were doing. They had Paramount Pictures, and they were a very successful company, and they decided that they wanted to change things in Memphis, and so they did. And the things that they changed made it lose its appeal for me.
What were the changes?
They changed the outlook. They made us feel as though, well, they made us meet a quota as far as how much music we produced. That was the first thing that really affected me, because we were always able to have our down, dry periods when we just couldn't come up with anything and when it just wasn't happening, and so everybody would get tense and, we would argue and we just absolutely had no music. But then, to come out of that, we would come up with something great. But Gulf and Western sent memos that caused us to change our production techniques to the fact that we had three bands going around the clock, and they wanted a certain number of albums in a certain time period, and So the president and the vice president, the people who were running the company, had to bring other producers in from other cities. They brought in producers from Los Angeles and Detroit, you know, because they had to meet these quotas, and it became a different company.
So when you left, did you leave on your own?
Yes, I did. I left all by myself. Nobody came with me.
What was your life like when you moved to Los Angeles?
Well, my life was uncertain for a while, but then I found friends in California that rescued me, and so I was able to survive out here.
And how did your musical life change?
Well, as I said, I found friends who were also somewhat nonconformists who rescued me. I met Clarence Avant, who at the time was one of the leading entrepreneurs, African-American entrepreneurs in the music industry, and he had a startup label that he was working with in California, and he had this guy that was building airplane toilets in Inglewood who had songs that he really loved. His name was Bill Withers. And
Bill Withers was building airplane toilets?
absolutely. And Clarence called up and sent Bill out to my ranch in Malibu, and Bill came up out there with a little tablet full of papers and an old beat-up guitar and started to sing songs. And he had some great songs in there, so I was able to work with him. And then
so you actually helped discover him?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Okay.
And I had friends that introduced me to Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss, and they were starting a record label. And
that was A&M Records.
Uh-huh, yeah. So we had a relationship, so I worked with them for a few years and ended up producing and arranging albums on Rita Coolidge and various people on their label. And I actually ended up doing solo albums on A&M Records during that time. I was able to survive.
And you produced Willie Nelson's, now classic Stardust album.
Yes, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yes, that was one of the reasons why I think I made the right decision because I was able to work in some different genres that I wouldn't have been able to do at Stax Records.
Mm-hmm.
Stax wanted to keep it pretty much Memphis soul, which was fine, but Stax was not ever going to be, I don't think, a pop label or a country label, so I don't think I would have been able to take Willie Nelson there or Earl Klug. I don't think we would have been able to do jazz there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And your tastes are so wide-ranging.
You
wanted to work in a wide-ranging way.
Yes, it's one of my greatest disadvantages, liking so many different kinds of music.
Can I ask you about your name?
I'm named after my father, Booker T. Jones Sr., and he was named after Booker T. Washington, and the name is Booker Taliaferro. Taliaferro is the middle name.
And how did you end up like dropping the Jones from the professional part of your name? Because it was like Booker T. and the MGs, and everybody knows you as Booker T.
Well, yeah, the band needed a name when we recorded Green Onions. So Al Jackson, the drummer, What do we call it? And he said, "Well, Booker T and the," and they just came up with MGs.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little, this guy, this engineer on the song, Chips Moman, was driving a little British Leyland sports car. It's called an MG. I don't know if you've ever seen those.
Mm-hmm.
And he had it parked outside. He used to do tricks with it and everything in the snow, you know. And so he looked out the window, Booker T and the MGs.
It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Booker T and Terry Gross recorded in 2007. Booker T's new album is called Potato Hole. 50 years after its publication, Strunk and White's Elements of Style still influences our thinking about language, particularly our disapproval of the passive voice. But our linguist Jeff Nunberg thinks the passive has gotten a bad rap.
For its 50th anniversary edition, Strunk and White's Elements of Style has been given the full biblical treatment in a shiny black hardcover with a title stamped in gold. But there was nothing less like a Bible when the book first appeared in 1959. It was more like a tract, an ostentatiously slender little volume that mixed sensible advice with idiosyncratic fetishes about punctuation and usage. The book had a quirky charm, and its style was a model of pith. But by all rights, it should have gone out of print around 1965. if only so that its devotees could have the pleasure of hunting it down in the bargain bins of secondhand bookstores. Some critics have been hard on the book. In a recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, the linguist Jeff Pullum called it over-opinionated and under-informed, and said that it had degraded American students' grasp of English grammar. But you can't fault Strunk and White if their whims and prejudices have been canonized and sucked up into a cloud of free-floating linguistic folklore. It's just a sign of how muddled and reflexive our received linguistic wisdom has become. Take the way we vilify the passive voice as weak and wussy. Strunk and White disposed of this matter in 200 words, and they actually weren't that doctrinaire about it. But it's become an article of grammatical faith, which teachers and usage guides defend with judiciously chosen examples. Compare, "I kicked a can, and a can was kicked by me." Can't you hear how the first is more vigorous, more muscular, more butch? But then there are plenty of passives that lose their oomph when they're made into actives. Imagine some Strunken White fan revising all the titles in the popular musical catalogs so that we're left with the Animals' "Please Don't Let Anybody Misunderstand Me" and the Eurythmics' "This Is What They Make Sweet Dreams Out Of," not to mention Elvis's "Someone or Something Has Shaken Me All Up." But the popular rap on the passive isn't just that it's limp, but that it's deceptive, a way to avoid taking responsibility for your actions. The textbook example is "Mistakes Were Made," which CNN's Bill Schneider described as the past exonerative. That charge is due not to Strunk and White, but to George Orwell's Politics in the English Language, another quirky usage essay that's been absorbed into the cultural wallpaper. The Orwellian overtones of the passive have become so strong that a lot of people use the term for any sentence that sounds evasive, whatever its grammatical structure happens to be. On CNN.com, a self-styled language expert named Paul Payak chastises Obama for using the passive in the sentence, "There will be setbacks." In The New Republic, Jason Zangerly hears the passive voice in a prediction that Axelrod will become a lightning rod for public concern. And in a New Yorker piece not long ago, Nancy Franklin ridiculed Bernard Madoff for using the passive voice when he said, "When I began the Ponzi scheme, I believed it would end shortly." That statement may have been disingenuous, but it didn't have any passives in it. But the point was missed not just by Franklin, but by the platoon of checkers and editors who famously vet every sentence before it can appear in the magazine. If nobody can identify a passive sentence at E.B. White's own New Yorker, maybe it's time to abandon the term. On the Language Log blog, the linguist Mark Liberman was prompted to announce its end with Python-esque finality. "Passive voice has ceased to be, it has expired, kicked the bucket, and shuffled off this mortal coil. It is an ex-grammatical term." And certainly a lot of the confusion has to do with the term passive voice itself. The style guides are always saying things like, "As the name implies, the passive makes writing sound weak and ineffectual." But the grammatical term passive doesn't have anything to do with passivity or unassertiveness. The Latin word passivus is related to the verb patior, or suffer, the same root that shows up in the noun patient and in the Passion of Christ. The passive is just the construction we use to focus on the one who undergoes or endures the action of the verb. And if using the passive can sometimes be culpable, there are also times when it's morally imperative. The writer Julia Kristeva once said that learning the passive is one of the things that makes us human. It's the device that enables us to put ourselves in the place of the people who wind up as the direct objects of history, the done to rather than the doers. You think of all the nouns we derive from the passive forms of verbs, the abused, the oppressed, the persecuted, the dispossessed. And the passive voice is particularly useful to have around in a time when people are being laid off, tossed out of their homes, dropped from their medical plans, and generally worked over. There's a familiar cadence to those strings of passives. It's the syntax Orwell used when he talked about history's victims. Defenseless villages are bombarded from the air, the inhabitants driven out into the countryside, the cattle machine-gunned, the huts set on fire with incendiary bullets. Nothing limp about that.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist and the author of the new book, The Years of Talking Dangerously.
I was Union Jack, Kerouac, John Birch, Stop and Search, Rolling Stone, and Beatle till I'm blind.
I've been Ayn Randed, nearly branded communist, cause I'm left-handed. That's the hand I use. Well, never mind. I've been Walt Disney, Diz Disley, John Lennon, Krishna Menon, Walter Brennan, punched out Cassius Clay. I have heard the truth from Lenny Bruce, and all my wealth won't buy me help, so I smoke a pint of tea a day.
That's Paul Simon singing a simple desultory philippic recorded in 1965.